difficulty breathing, pressure on the chest, lightheadedness, kind of almost a brain fog.
State workers in Juneau say their building is making them sick. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, musher Dee Dee Jonro describes what to look for in a lead dog.
He can be very, very, very much of a knothead, which a leader has to be. A leader has to have a little bit of rebellion in them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Senate is running a little behind in rewriting the state's oil and gas tax statute. President Gary Stevens of Kodiak this afternoon pointed out that the Senate Resources Committee missed today's goal of moving its tax bill onto the Finance Committee.
I hope to be leaving here on the 22nd. At this point, with all of the amendments that are being discussed, my goal at this point is to make sure that we get it out before folks leave for the Energy Council. So that's on the 8th of March, I believe. So we've had to adjust it because of the interest in the bill and all of the amendments that are out there.
Stephen says the Resources Committee is already expecting some 20 amendments to the bill, which will likely be dealt with individually. The reason for making a schedule for the bill to follow through the Senate was originally to provide adequate time for the Finance Committee to deal with the changes and to deliver it to the House for consideration at least 30 days before the end of the session. Under that timetable, the House would have begun work on the bill by March 16th. There's no new estimate on final Senate action. Speaker Mike Chenault says it's too early to decide how much time the House will actually need to work on the bill, but he anticipates consideration of some of the issues in the Senate plan can begin before the Senate finishes with it.
We'll watch the process, and we'll have an idea on what they're planning on sending, and you know, we'll start working on some of the things that we see in the background to try to see if we can get it done in the time frame they send it to us at, or if we take longer or we don't do it. So, you know, that's 50 days away, and we'll see.
Stevens says the Senate bipartisan majority will hold an internal discussion of the bill Friday before the Resources Committee begins work on the amendments. The state is negotiating a new lease for the Department of Labor building in Juneau, even as employees who work there continue to suffer ill health effects. Water damage, mold, and air quality issues have long plagued the structure, known as the Plywood Palace. But under the current lease terms, the state is limited in the improvements it can require the building's absentee landlord to make. The two parties have now engaged a mediator to help settle a dispute over the terms of the new lease and repairs the owner would be required to make. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Jade Bickmore dreads going to work every day at the Department of Labor building. She likes her job, but hates the environment.
Start out with sneezing, headaches, burning eyes, sinus pain and pressure, difficulty breathing, pressure on the chest, lightheadedness, kind of almost a brain fog.
State Wage and Hour investigator Mike Notar has had some symptoms, though he says not as bad as many of his coworkers. He says the building definitely seems to be the culprit.
I had a coworker had to go home the other day. He was coughing violently, and when he got home, he called me and he said, "I'm not coughing anymore."
And they're not alone. Earlier this month, more than 40 members of the Alaska State Employees Association attended a union-sponsored meeting for any worker who believes the building may be causing health problems. Supervisors who spoke on background report daily absenteeism rates around 20% for some divisions in the building. The state's chief procurement officer, Vern Jones, told lawmakers in a recent House Finance Subcommittee hearing that the state has entered into mediated negotiations with the labor building's private owners in hopes of forcing them to address any mold or air quality issues.
The HVAC problems that some of the employees have reported, heating, ventilation, air conditioning, as well as there had been in the past organic growth mold found in the building, and we're in negotiations with the owners to open up the walls, examine what's there, if there's any mold or other substances that shouldn't be there, to have them remediated and cleaned up.
In an interview with KTOO, Jones declined to be more specific, citing a confidentiality agreement as part of the terms of the mediated negotiations. Built in the early 1980s, the Labor Building has been rapidly deteriorating in recent years. A water leak in 2005 prompted replacement of some carpet. A downspout burst in 2008, flooding part of the first floor. Continued complaints about water leakage eventually led the owners to re-side the exterior, which was completed in 2009. But Jones says past lease terms did not allow the state to request specific improvements.
The state's leases generally have performance specifications in them, so we describe how the building has to perform, the conditions that must be present in the building, without really getting into design or technical details.
Late last year, the state hired a consultant from Seattle to prepare a report on the conditions. The firm recommended inspection of the roof to determine the source of various leaks, opening walls to determine the nature of the organic growth seen throughout the facility, as well as air quality testing. The consultant noted several areas of cracked wallboard in the building, as well as a pungent odor in at least one room. Juneau Republican Representative Kathy Munoz sponsored legislation 3 years ago that could have led to construction of a new state office complex in the capital city for employees from the Departments of Labor, Public Safety, and Fish and Game. The bill died in the Senate in 2010. Then last year, the Parnell administration announced it was scrapping plans for a new building and renovating the old Fish and Game offices in Douglas instead. In her talks with the administration, Munoz says officials have committed to major upgrades to the Labor Building.
We need to deal with the problems in that building immediately. There's no question about that. That needs to happen.
Long-term, Juneau's legislative delegation has said they're not giving up on a new state office building, though it will be significantly scaled down from the original proposal. Labor Department employee Jade Bickmore says a new building would be the best solution. But until then, the least the state should do is move the affected employees out of the Labor Building while it investigates the cause of the health problems.
Take the people that are affected out of the building so they're not having to be in the building while the work's being done.
State Chief Procurement Officer Vern Jones says employees will be moved around within the building during remediation. Jones expects the mediated negotiations with the building's owners to be complete before the current lease expires at the end of June. He declined to say how long the state is seeking to extend the agreement. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Representative Don Young says it will be tough to turn around the Air Force's planned move of an F-16 fighter jet squadron from Eielson to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. The Air Force says transferring the squadron, which is used for training in areas near Eielson, will save money. Speaking in Fairbanks yesterday, Young echoed the message of Alaska Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich, saying the best tactic is to disprove the alleged cost savings.
It's going to be very difficult, but that's where the city of Fairbanks, state of Alaska, I've made suggestions. We're going to find out what information they base that decision on, see if we can encourage them to look at the mission. And because there's no way they can really implement this mission with the planes being in Anchorage. Number one, they have to fly up here to do the training. That's expensive. So how does that save money? But again, I'm not telling the Air Force what to do. I'm going to try to explain to them. I hope Fairbanks does the same thing, that this is really not a good move.
The military is making similar moves across the country as it looks to trim the budget. And Young says Alaska does not have the clout of more populous states in the lower 48 to fight back.
We're out of sight, out of mind. We're 5,500 miles away. We have a three-person delegation. And why they still insist on holding on like Fort Hood or Fort Lewis or Fort Yuccamuck, or what do you call it? They have no training capability. But remember, they may have 35, 40 legislators, and, you know, out of sight, out of mind, we're a long ways away. So that's always a challenge we have as a delegation.
Young says another challenge is that the jets and the over 1,000 service members and support personnel that go with them are being moved from one Alaska base to another, not out of state. There's concern that the F-16 move is a first step toward closing Eielson when there's another round of base realignment and closure, but Young said he's been assured by Chairman of the Military and Armed Services Committee, Buck McKinnon, there will not be a BRAC round during the next 4 years. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a movie premiere with a purpose.
The whole premise behind why we're doing this project is that we want parents to talk to their kids.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
Cheryl Hatch, the former University of Alaska Fairbanks Sneddon Chair of Journalism, is in Afghanistan visiting Fort Wainwright Stryker Brigade troops. Last week, Hatch was in Kenjikak, which is the combat outpost for Charlie Company in the 1st Battalion, 5th Infantry Regiment of the 125th Stryker Brigade. Hatch says it's in the Panjway District, an area she says is in the heart of the Taliban. Hatch is working on a series of stories for the Christian Science Monitor following an Army female engagement team as they make contact with Afghan women to help them assess their access to health care and schools.
They were able to do things like midwifery programs, well baby programs, some sewing, and other types of teaching and vocational things to help them. But they're just getting started here in Panjway.
Hatch is no stranger to traveling alone in conflict areas. She's covered Middle East and African combat in the past. She's also been in Kenjikak before and plans to visit all the different companies while she's in Afghanistan.
Bravo, the station at Spiro and Gar, and there's Alpha Company that's farther down in the Horn. So with luck, I'll be able to visit all the different companies within this battalion and then maybe one other battalion while I'm here.
Hatch says although the battalion has been hit hard, they've suffered 21 deaths and IEDs continue to be a problem. She says they are making good progress. She says work clearing IEDs has been productive, and they are returning facilities to the control of local government and performing joint operations with the Afghan National Army, or ANA. Sergeant Robert Taylor agrees. Sergeant Taylor is approaching his 2-year service anniversary. He says he joined the Army late, going to college first and working as a financial advisor before deciding to join the service. The 28-year-old says he didn't know how much he'd love it and want to make it a career. He says they're making progress suppressing insurgent activity and turning things over to the ANA.
Which is a big success for our ability to be able to lead this country. And once we completed that, we're now working on our second area. And everything here is going as smoothly as it did before. And the transition is going well. So from what I've had to experience with this war, very successful.
Sergeant Taylor says morale is good as they prepare to end their deployment, possibly within the next 60 days. He says all soldiers have fears, but family, friends, and plans for the future help them stay motivated.
What everyone's doing, it seems that the general public supports us. Even if they don't support the war, they seem to support the sacrifices that we make, and it's very noticeable. And when you just have someone that acknowledges you for doing what you're doing, whether they agree with it or not, it makes you feel good. It makes you feel like you're a part of something that's much bigger than you.
Sergeant Sean Edson is also part of the Fort Wainwright Stryker team. The 26-year-old is nicknamed Bluegrass, not because he's a musician, but simply because, being from Georgia, he loves bluegrass music. He says the Afghan people, many of them farmers, were apprehensive about the Army's presence at first, but when they realized the soldiers were there to help, things changed.
We've been here almost a year now, and just from the time we
first got here up until now, you can really see a big transition in the population, how people are coming out more, and it seems like it's a lot secure and people are enjoying themselves a lot better.
Journalist Cheryl Hatch says a lieutenant colonel she spoke to told her the work list they wanted to accomplish in 12 months has been completed in 6. The soldiers are still going out on missions and patrols, but have started the transition toward preparing to leave the country and ending their deployment. Military families with members receiving medical care from the Alaska VA Healthcare Hospital in Anchorage have a new place to stay, APRN's Heather Arono reports.
Last weekend, the Alaska Fisher House joined a network of over 50 facilities operating across the United States and Germany. These comfort homes are a place where military families can stay while a family member is receiving medical treatment. The Alaska Fisher House is located at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Ken Fisher, chairman and CEO of Fisher House Foundation, was at J-Bear for the dedication ceremony.
Fisher House offers a home away from home for families of those servicemen, women, or veterans who have been sick or wounded in service to this nation, lodging at no expense for as long as the hospital stay warrants.
Though Friday marked the dedication of the Alaska Fisher House, its doors have been open to military families since December 22nd last year. Since then, at least 5 families have been able to use the Fisher House. Spreading out to 10,000 square feet to accommodate 12 living spaces, the average cost of one of these buildings is around $4 million. The price tag for the Alaska home came in a little higher due to a special feature, heated sidewalks.
Because the families are too busy going to the hospital to see their loved ones, and there's not a lot of time around to shovel the sidewalks, so we actually heated the sidewalks to keep the snow from piling up.
Fisher says the heated sidewalks will also keep the houses fully accessible for servicemen and women in wheelchairs. The Fisher House program was founded in 1990 by Zachary and Elizabeth Fisher, making Ken Fisher the third generation in his family to head up the organization. He says he respects the dedication of servicemen and women, and the sacrifice of military families can sometimes go unrecognized.
What we seek to do is honor the sacrifices of military families by easing the burden on them, both economically and also stress-related, because spiritually a kind of a support system forms in the house. So the families coach each other. They share the joy of the good days. They'll help each other on bad days. So it's kind of a community within a house.
Once each house is built, the care and maintenance is given over to the branch of the military that the base belongs to. Fisher attributes the success of the program to a public-private partnership with the government, as well as generosity from the local communities.
So these public-private partnerships, or the kind that we have, I hope is the wave of the future, because there's always going to be unmet needs. Whether we like it or not, there's always going to be unmet needs.
Fisher says the private sector has skill sets and infrastructures in place that can help ease the burden on government, which would go a long way to provide solutions instead of complaints.
You know, say, I can do it. And you put a mechanism together, and then the government comes in and do what they can do.
6 to 7 more Fisher houses are in the process of construction or will be opening soon. In Anchorage, I'm Heather Arono.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
An air permit granted by the Environmental Protection Agency to Shell Oil for a drilling ship in Alaska's Chukchi Sea is being challenged by 9 environmental and Alaska Native groups in federal appeals court. The groups want the permit sent back to the EPA for reconsideration. Earth Justice Attorney Colin O'Brien says the EPA failed to make sure all standards were met for a major new source of pollution in the Arctic. Shell hopes to use the ship to drill 3 exploratory wells in the Chukchi Sea this summer. Shell spokeswoman Kelly Otteve says Shell retrofit its catalytic exhaust systems and will use ultra-low sulfur fuel on all of its vessels. She says Shell is confident in EPA's findings that emissions will not harm the airshed. The importance of a baby's earliest years is becoming more well understood with new research and a handful of outreach efforts across the state aimed to get that message out to parents and caregivers. One of those outreach efforts is a new movie that premieres this weekend across the state. Kids These Days reporter Jessica Cochran has more.
Between February 25th and March 4th, more than 130 sites, from libraries to workplaces to private homes, will premiere a new movie, Babies on Track. The 14-minute video features parents and children doing activities together and talking as they go, washing dishes, folding laundry, or, like this father and son, heading out together on a fishing boat.
Big baskets pick up the fish, and then they slide into that little part right there, and then they slide into that basket, and then you come up with a boat like this, and you reach in there and you take that fish.
The movie was filmed in 3 locations in Alaska and was produced by local filmmaker Mary Kotsky. It's all designed to get one simple message across. The best way to help a baby's brain development is to communicate. The idea for the movie came from 2 similar films, one designed for Latino families in Chicago that was so engaging, rural Alaskans loved it and wanted their own version. Babies on Track is a project of Best Beginnings. Coordinator Barbara Brown says everyone who attends one of the premieres will receive a copy of the DVD and 2 board books full of pictures, but no words. One features Alaska baby faces, and the other Alaska-themed objects like boots and geese. That gives caregivers more to talk about.
Parents use more words, and there's more conversation with wordless books than books that have words. When little kid books have words, see, spot, jump, that's what the parent says as they're reading. When they have a picture of a dog, they say, oh, do you see the dog? Does that look like the dog we know? What do dogs say? And a whole conversation starts. The whole premise behind why we're doing this project is that we want parents to talk to their kids.
In Unalakleet, babies will walk a red carpet to the premiere and sit in special seating. In the Tok area, the folks who distribute books through Imagination Library will hold 4 different premiere events. Carrie Beeman is coordinating them.
The video talks about how to keep kids on track, to talk, respond, ask questions, connect, you know, keep at it, sing and tell stories. Thought, wow, track, that would be a great theme, you know, for the event. So we are going to have activities about with tracks, like footprints. So we're going to have all sorts of different activities for making a footprint keepsake. And the Parks Department had sent us a tracks kit, different animal tracks. So we're going to utilize those during the event.
I'm Jessica Cochran.
With the Iditarod just around the corner, mushers are making final preparations with their dogs. Finding the right dogs for the job begins months, sometimes years, before the race. KSKA reporter Daisha Eaton visits with a woman who's had 15 top 10 finishes in the race, Dee Dee Johnroe, and her team to learn what makes a good leader.
It's the perfect place to raise sled dogs, in the woods about an hour and a half north of Anchorage, just outside the tiny town of Willow. That's where musher Dee Dee Johnroe breeds, trains, and lives with her dogs, all 80 of them. Johnroe is one of the foremost female mushers competing in the Iditarod. Her career spans 3 decades. This will be her 30th race. She says her dogs have had a lot to do with her success. Every dog is important, she says, but it's critical to have a good leader.
Good leaders pick themselves. They're the ones that see the task at hand, take to it, and they want to please, but they have that independence that, you know, they kind of can make decisions on their own as well. They evolve.
This year, her lead dog is Omnistar.
Omnistar is an Alaskan husky. He weighs between 49 and 52 pounds. And this will be his sixth Iditarod. He's 8 years old.
The lanky husky, the color of creme brulee, is named after a Pokemon character, along with the rest of his litter. He's a far cry from a classic husky. He has longer legs than you would expect, and
he's got beautiful brown eyes, and his ears, one stands up really pretty straight, and the other one kind of folds over a little bit. His legs are long, his back is long. He's almost deer-like.
He's also quieter than the other dogs, rarely barks, and when he sees John Rowe, he delicately rests his front paws up onto her shoulders and hugs her, almost like a human.
Very, very, very sweet.
But John Rowe says he also has another side.
He can be very, very, very much of a knothead, which a leader has to be. A leader has to have a little bit of rebellion in them, a little bit of, I'm doing it my way. If they don't have that self-esteem, that confidence that, you know, I'm always right kind of a thing, it's hard to get them to lead in difficult situations.
Like when it's icy, or when they encounter another dog team or a moose, or when the going just gets tough. It was a situation like that when John Rowe first noticed OmniStar had potential to lead in the final stretch of an Iditarod several years back.
We left Unalakleet and we were headed over to Shaktulik, and now we had less dogs that were really sure what was going on, and he was pulling really hard in swing. And then I moved him over to lead to see if he would pull as strongly in lead. And in fact, he took to it really well.
Six Iditarods later, OmniStar is set to lead John Rowe's team to the 2012 finish, something she says has to do with breeding and luck.
Yeah, I've been working on it a long time. I really have, and I think this is a gorgeous team, just beautiful. Now we'll have to see what the racetrack gives us.
Now it's time to exercise the dogs.
OmniStar, come here, buddy.
John Rowe gets out the booties.
Come here. That's my boy.
She pulls on the harnesses and starts hooking them up. She puts OmniStar in the lead. He sits patiently while John Rowe connects the rest of the team. The other dogs can't stay still. They're pacing and pulling, yelping and whining. Their barking reaches a fever pitch until it's time to go. The team quiets down and they follow OmniStar down the trail. In Willow, I'm Daisha Eaton.
To see a video of John Rowe with her lead dog, OmniStar, go to alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Daisha Eaton and Jessica Cochran in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Heather Arono from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.